I'm Molly Wansell.
And I'm Geoffrey Wansell.
And for the last 16 years or thereabouts, we have been having lunch every Saturday, and often our conversation turns to murder.
And that's what's prompted us to launch this true crime podcast called Blood Ties.
Hi everyone, welcome back to the Blood Ties podcast. I'm Molly Wansell and I'm here with my father, Geoffrey Wansell.
Hi everyone, welcome back. Thank you for listening. It's a delight to be back with Molly, who's been busy with other things, but here we are together.
Hi.
And Mo is very chastened because she was a bit late.
I was very late. And I was running an hour behind schedule.
And I fell over and couldn't get up. So
we're a pair of
complete nitwits.
It's a disaster. But I'm falling apart, Geoffrey.
Yeah, I'm falling apart, Molly.
No, we're both falling apart.
Well, I don't know. I'm comparatively pleased. So I've got going and I'm organised and I'm up and done. And I've done what I think is a very interesting case.
Good-o.
Let me tell you why. Not long ago, about a couple of weeks, I went to Eastbourne in East Sussex. It's on the south coast of England, and it's very genteel. It was originally mostly owned, and I think most of it still is owned, by the Duke of Devonshire. And it became a sort of retirement community. Unfortunately, that gentility has tended to weaken because, like a lot of the south coast of England seaside towns, drugs have taken their toll, and there's a lot of drug dealing, a lot of drugs. And
do you have first hand experience of that?
No, I don't. No. But I know people who do, as they say. I can honestly say I've never done any drugs in my whole life. Never even smoked a cigarette.
Never smoked a cigarette.
No, not even behind a bicycle sheds.
No.
It's amazing.
You're so straight-laced.
I don't think I'm straight-laced.
You're not at all. It's pretty amazing that you...
Yeah, but it just never appealed to me.
You like a glass of wine, though.
Oh, I do, yes. But as you know, I don't drink spirits anymore, so...
No, just the wines.
Just the wines. But, you know, one of the things is that this case is based entirely in Eastbourne, it's East Sussex. And I went to see the house.
Mm-hmm.
That the man lived in,
mm-hmm.
which is in, it was then called Seaside Road. It's now called something different. It leads down to the seafront, not far from the pier. There is quite a nice pier at Eastbourne. I walked out it. It was rather fun.
The last pier I went on was Cromer.
Oh, gosh, yes. Well, the last pier I went on was Brighton when I got the photograph taken for the book. That was the last time I'd been on the pier.
Yeah, nice.
It was really nice, actually.
That man Rory that took your picture, who's friends with my colleague Harrison. My friend and colleague Harrison.
Yes. So, you know.
Guess what I did last night, Dad?
What did you do last night?
I went to see Hannah Einbinder do stand-up. She's the young woman who plays the young writer in Hacks.
Gosh.
She was so good. She was so funny. You would have loved it.
Wonderful.
You would have absolutely loved
it. I think Hacks is terrific.
I know, you love Hacks.
Yeah. Oh,
tell people what Hacks is.
Oh, Hacks is a series on
Amazon
Prime. Essentially about a very well-established female comedian who might be said to be slightly on the wane. And she's approached by a young woman who is also a comic writer.
Who's sort of been cancelled for saying the wrong thing.
Yes, but she nevertheless inspires the older woman to modernise a little and do new things.
They start working together, don't they?
It's a wonderful show. Well, two seasons.
She's so funny. Her stand-up was so funny.
I can imagine. Where did you see it?
Soho, downstairs.
Oh, okay.
Theater, yeah.
Yeah,
so good.
Isn't that good?
It was so good.
Oh, I think that's great. What a lovely thing to do.
Mm.
My alternative, I wasn't going to go anyway, but my alternative last night would have been to go to see John Gabriel Borkman.
Oh, in 7 hours of something.
Well, Simon Russell Beale giving us John Gabriel Bateman. Now, he's a fine actor, but it's such a dull, it's such a gloomy play. I mean, it just takes your breath away how gloomy it is. And I said, I don't think I need watch another performance of John Gabriel Bateman. Thank you very much.
She could go to the National and watch another version of The Crucible.
I could do.
It's got Erin Doherty in it, who's the woman who plays Princess Anne in The Crown. I think she's so good.
Ah. I could do. Trouble is, I've seen The Crucible.
I know, that was the joke.
I've seen The
Crucible. I thought you would say no because you've seen it so many times.
Yes. I mean, I think, I tell you, one of the first times I ever saw it was at the Aldwych in London, and I was 15. Because I did my German O level before GCSEs, just to prove how old I am. And we talked about what I'd been to see in German.
In your German oral exam.
My German oral exam, and I discussed The Crucible.
Wow, that's complicated.
Yes, it is a bit, isn't it? Anyway, so the reason for this story, which I'm going to tell in two parts.
Oh, yes, let's get on with it.
I'm going to tell in two parts.
Because you've been to Eastbourne.
Because he lived in Eastbourne. And it's the story of Dr. John Bodkin Adams.
Okay, so this is Dr. John Bodkin Adams, part one.
Yeah. John Bodkin Adams was born in Northern Ireland, Ulster, in 1899. Actually, then it wasn't Ulster because the partition didn't happen until 1921, but never mind, let's not get too careful about it. He was born into a Plymouth Brethren family, a very strict evangelical Anglican group. His father was a watchmaker. John Bodkin Adams was the firstborn. The wife was called Ellen, as I recall. His father was called Samuel. And Bodkin Adams was born in January 1899. A second son, William, was born in 1903. But sadly died in the Spanish influenza epidemic in 1918, the great epidemic before COVID struck the world this year, this century. And his father, Samuel, died of a stroke in 1914 at the beginning of the First World War. Bodkin Adams was a chubby, round-faced, slightly pasty, confident man. Young man. But he was a bit of a plodder at school and a bit of a lone wolf. But nevertheless, he did go to Queen's University in Belfast, and in 1921 he went to study medicine, but he wasn't clever enough to do honours, and so he got offered a job as an assistant houseman in the Bristol Royal Infirmary in the west of England. But he wasn't very good at that. In fact, after a year, they suggested he did, how about trying general practice? So, and they suggested a Christian general practice.
Not to do a disservice to any GPs out there.
No, I'm not being rude to GPs out there. I'm sorry. He joined a Christian practice in Eastbourne, East Sussex.
Christian doctors.
Christian doctors.
Did you go to doctor by faith back then?
You could do. I mean, quite a lot of people did. Also, there was no National Health Service at this point, so you were paying to go to the doctor.
So you wanted to see a good Christian one.
You wanted to see a good Christian one.
So
he joined the practice, and before long, he moved his mother, Ellen, and his cousin, Sarah, into Eastbourne to join him. In fact, he never left Eastbourne. In 1929, in other words, he'd been there about 7 years, he borrowed £2,000 from one of his patients, who was quite a wealthy furniture manufacturer, to buy a house. And the house he bought was called Kent Lodge, which is still there, 18 rooms. £2,000 in 1929 was probably the equivalent of about £110,000, £120,000
now. A lot of money to borrow from a patient.
Yes, but even, oh, it gets better. I mean, this is real Bodkin Adams for you. This shows the good doctor in a proper light. He then proceeds to invite himself round to the Mahood house at mealtimes, sometimes taking his mother and cousin with him so that they have to be fed. When the man who gave him the £2,000, which incidentally I don't think was ever repaid, when he died, the mother described Bodkin Adams as a real scrounger. He would literally turn up for supper. And it also took to charging things to their account in local shops. We are talking about the 1920s, late 20s, early 30s, when that sort of thing happened very much more. You could say, oh, it's on Mrs. So-and-so's account, and the grocer would divvy up the stuff and put it in a little bag and you take it home. He was, how can I put it precisely, unconventional as a doctor. But that all becomes a little clearer as we go on. But perhaps I should just say another glimpse of Bodkin Adams's unconventionality was in 1933, he got engaged to a woman called Nora O'Hara. Her father, who was, I'm pleased to say, well off, of course he would be, wouldn't he, knowing Bodkin Adams, bought them a house and furnished it. Bodkin Adams called the wedding off. One reason given was that his mother didn't want her son, her only now surviving son, marrying trade. She wanted better for him. There may have been another reason, but we'll get back to that in a little while. The other reason given, Bodkin Adams' reason, was that he tried to persuade Nora's father to change his will in favour of his daughter's, so that if the father died, Nora would be in line for a substantial payment.
But he wouldn't.
Yeah, but he wouldn't. So Bodkin Adams said, well, let's not bother then.
Okay.
Bodkin Adams developed what can only be described, as I say, as a very unconventional system. And in 1935... we are talking a long time ago here. In 1935, he inherited £7,385 from a patient called Matilda Whitten, which is the equivalent of about £450,000 today. The will was contested by Whitten's family, but they lost. There you see the first sign of Bodkin Adams's handwriting. He focused on rich, elderly patients, mostly women, who would then proceed, because he had a very nice bedside manner and a rather convivial face, who would then proceeded to leave him all sorts of things.
All their money.
Yes. Molly's looking up his picture.
I am.
Not long after Matilda Whitten left him this large inheritance, he began receiving anonymous postcards, which suggested he was bumping off his patients to get the money. In fact, he got about three or four a year, right up until the outbreak of the Second World War in 1939, and then they restarted again in 1945, after the end of the war. In 1939, the realities of Bodkin Adams's treatment started to surface. He was treating a woman called Mrs. Agnes Pike. Basically, what he did was he gave her morphine and heroin mixed in injections, which rendered Mrs. Pike pretty much blank. I mean, she couldn't remember her name, her age, where she lived. In fact, nothing. The family, she was an elderly lady, the family were most perturbed, and they called another doctor who decided that she had absolutely no need of the morphine and the heroin mix and proceeded not to prescribe it. Bodkin Adams was told to leave, get out of the case, and she recovered. She recovered her name, her age, where she lived, and she even went out shopping. So what you have is a sort of outline of what's going on in Bodkin Adams's life. During the war, Second World War, he studied anaesthesia and went to work at the local hospital, where he was remembered as being lazy, bungling. In fact, he confused the anaesthetic tube so much that patients started to wake up in the operation.
Jesus.
Or they turned blue. Most of the time, and I love this quote, one of his fellow doctors described him as always eating cakes and counting money.
He looks like he eats a lot of cakes.
Yes. I mean, it is funny in a way, but it's also incredibly creepy. But anyway, he goes through it. He doesn't get fired. I mean, he's still in Eastbourne. He's only doing one day a week in an anaesthetic at the hospital where they don't want him anyway. And he trundles along. By 1956, he's had so many inheritances that he's called the richest GP in England. He's got a Rolls Royce. He's got this huge house. He's got his mother and his cousin. And there he is, cheerful, avuncular, hail fellow, well met. And he's very, very well connected. His patients include the mayor of Eastbourne, Sir Roland Gwynn, whose brother just happens to be the MP for Eastbourne, the chief constable, the deputy chief constable. He is everyone's favourite doctor.
And untouchable because of it, I imagine.
I beg your pardon?
Untouchable because of it.
Well, I think that's a very good suggestion. But in 1956, by 1956, Bodkin Adams has been mentioned in the will of 132 of his patients.
Wow.
Yes, wow is the word. He's everybody's favourite doctor, not unlike Harold Shipman.
Hey, I was just thinking of the Shipman of it all.
Yes. But what makes Bodkin Adams so very special is that there was a series of anonymous calls.
What, following up from the postcards?
Following up from the postcards, alleging, and one in particular, which emerged in the Daily Mail, that there was a homosexual ring in Eastbourne involving a policeman, a magistrate, and a doctor. And the doctor was, of course,
Bodkin.
John Bodkin Adams, who, quotes, never married.
Bodders.
And, but of course, at that point, and we have to remember this, it was still a criminal offence.
Yeah.
Homosexuality was still a criminal offence. So that would have been a very serious allegation. But nevertheless, the magistrate in question was the said mayor of Eastbourne, Sir Roland Gwynn. So you are talking about a man who is well connected for whatever reason. I'm not saying for a second that any of those allegations were ever finally proved, but they were certainly floating around.
The plot thickens.
It does. So now we've got to 1956. Bodkin Adams is rich. His mother has died, and so sadly has his cousin. So he's living in Kent Lodge, his 18-room mansion, entirely on his own. He has a Rolls Royce. He's driven round. I mean, we are talking about the most remarkable thing. He's a chauffeur. He's got, I mean, it's extraordinary.
Why does he keep working? I suppose because he needs to keep stealing people's money. Well,
I think he wants more inheritances, don't you?
Yeah.
Okay. So, anyway, what things come to a head in July 1956 when an anonymous call was made about a death. Gertrude Hullett had died unexpectedly after being treated by Bodkin Adams, and she was only 50. The coroner, of course, he'd signed the death certificate. The coroner wasn't convinced that death was natural, so an investigation began. And Bodkin Adams said at the time that she had considered suicide, and that perhaps that's what she did. She took pills to kill herself. Nevertheless, a second post-mortem was held, which suggested she died from barbiturate poisoning. So now, this is no longer a case for the Eastbourne police, but for the Metropolitan Police, because in those days, murders in England were always investigated by the murder squad from Scotland Yard. Let's call Scotland Yard the famous... That doesn't happen now, but that's what happened then. So the murder squad is called, and a detective superintendent and detective sergeant are sent from London to examine the death of Mrs. Hullett. Detective Superintendent Herbert Hannon and Detective Sergeant Charles Hewitt arrive, and they become fixated on an idea, not, I have to say, unreasonably, that Bodkin Adams was killing his elderly patients for money. Though, in fact, that wasn't always the case. But nevertheless, these two detectives from Scotland Yard became convinced that Bodkin Adams was a serial killer. Bodkin Adams completely denied it. I've never heard such nonsense. It's total tosh. What on earth are you talking about? Hannon was a determined investigator and found out they only wanted to investigate cases between 1946 and 1956. They investigated 163 cases. And Hannon discovered that the nurses who were helping Bodkin Adams were occasionally asked to leave the room while Bodkin Adams gave his patients what he called special injections.
That's what they're calling it these days.
He would also, almost conventionally, isolate these elderly patients he was treating from their family. No, I don't think it would be a good idea if you saw them. It might upset them. The Attorney General of the day, Sir Reginald Manningham Buller, would have had to appear to prosecute any case of poisoning. Again, another slightly old-fashioned system that we had in those days. But wasn't entirely convinced by Hannon and Hewitt's investigation. In fact, I think at one point, Bodkin Adams said publicly, there was nothing deceitful in anything I did. But on October the 1st, 1956, Hannon met Adams to discuss what he called the rumours, and Bodkin Adams absolutely denied everything. No, nothing to do with it, whatever. even though he did admit that on occasions he lied when completing the death certificate and certifying the patients for cremation, that he wasn't benefiting from their will. Because one of the things you're supposed to do is to say, if you're benefiting, you've got to get somebody else.
Okay. And he was having them cremated.
And he was having them cremated. Yes, no chance of exhumation.
All looked pretty dodgy.
Okay. But Bontinck and Adams said, and I think this is the most wonderful quote of all, "Easing the passing of a dying person isn't all that wicked. She wanted to die. There can't be murder. That can't be murder. It's impossible to accuse a doctor."
Murder's murder, mate.
Finally, the police get a search warrant to look at Kent Lodge, Bontinck Adams' house, which is a treasure trove of material. Huge amounts of china, silverware, 20 new car tyres, wine, spirits, 6 guns in a glass-fronted display case, several automatic pistols, all of which were licensed because he said he went to the local gun club. A dozen very expensive cameras in leather cases. I mean, it's amazing if you think about it. This is all in the basement of Kent Lodge. But as this investigation develops and expands, the rumours about Bontinck Adams' sexuality start to surface again. And in fact, in December 1956, a memo from a Daily Mail journalist suggesting a gay relationship between a police officer, a magistrate and a doctor emerges. There's no doubt that the magistrate was Sir Roland Gwynne, Mayor of Eastbourne, who was, of course, Bontinck Adams' patient. Bontinck Adams used to visit him at 9 o'clock every morning. I don't know what his problem was, but 9 o'clock every morning is awfully regular. They went on holiday together. That year, 1956, they'd spent 3 weeks in Scotland together.
How delightful.
And the policeman was the Deputy Chief Constable of Eastbourne, Alexander Seekings. Detective Superintendent Hannan interviewed Gwynne at the beginning of 1957. And at that point, Gwynne broke off any contact with Bontinck Adams. Adams was arrested first on the 24th of November 1956 on 13 charges, including false statements on cremation certificates. He was given bail. On the 19th of December 1956, he was arrested for the murder of a lady called Edith Morell. "Murder? Murder? Can you prove it was murder?" he said. "I didn't think you could prove it." She was dying in any event. Edith Morell had suffered a stroke in June 1948 when she was visiting her son in Cheshire. She was 79 years old. She was transferred to hospital in Chester, and then on July the 5th was moved to Eastbourne, where she became Bontinck Adams' patient. Bontinck Adams prescribed morphine on the 9th of July 1948 and included heroin on the 21st of July 1948. She wasn't expected to last more than 6 months, but in fact, she survived for 2 years. And between 1948 and August 1950, she received routine injections of morphine and heroin from Bodkin Adams, but she was stable. But then she began to deteriorate in the autumn of 1950. And the dosages increased. She had included Bodkin Adams in her will. But then changed her mind. She'd promised Bodkin Adams a Rolls-Royce Silver Ghost, which she owned, as well as a huge chest of cutlery. But then she changed her mind and added a codicil to her will not long before she died. Bodkin Adams wrote the death certificate for Edith Morell, saying that she died of a stroke, and her son, out of gratitude to Bodkin Adams, gave him the Rolls Royce and the chest of cutlery. He then billed the estate for 1,100 visits, a total of £1,674. And it was that case that, in a way, became the cases, the prosecution's case against Bodkin Adams. But there was another one. Much later, this was, remember, she died in 1950.
Mm-hmm.
In 1956, a lady called Gertrude Hullett died in July. And it was that case that really focused attention on Bodkin Adams. It so happened that she was a relative of a quite well-known music hall star called Leslie Henson, who telephoned the police and said that he didn't believe that these were natural causes. About a week before she died, Mrs. Hullett gave Bodkin Adams a cheque for £1,000 to buy an MG that her husband had promised him. He then got it specially cleared. It was then suggested because he knew she was going to die. But nevertheless, and it is extraordinary in a way, she was found in a coma on the 19th of July after taking an overdose of sodium barbiturates. And on the 21st of August, the inquest decided she'd committed suicide. Incidentally, she'd also left Bodkin Adams' Rolls Royce.
What does he need all these bloody cars for?
Oh, he loved it. He loved swanking. He really did. He was He was very confident underneath it all.
Clearly.
You know? But it'd be interesting to know, he sold that one 6 days before his arrest.
Mm.
So here we have, and this is the end of part one.
Mm.
Here we have a doctor practising in the leafy Sussex seaside town of Eastbourne, with its view of Beachy Head and the Seven Sisters, the White Cliffs, all the rest. You know, systematically receiving money from elderly patients, many of whom are women, but also enjoying the most incredible reputation in the town as not only respectable, but probably the wealthiest general practitioner in England.
Mm. I think it's going to unravel.
Well, that's what makes part two so interesting.
Find out in part two. Thanks, Dad. I think I knew that much about Bodkin Adams.
I don't think many people do. It's at the time, it was a sensation.
Mm.
I can remember it as a boy.
Well, it would have been, I can imagine.
Well, especially when we get to the trial.
Ooh,
which is part two. So that's the end of the first part of Dr. John Bodkin Adams.
Super, thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Muchas gracias.
Yes. So you not only went to see stand-up, what else have you seen recently? I've been watching all the Jeffrey Dahmer on Netflix.
Oh, yeah, is it good? Someone emailed us asking if you'd seen it.
I've watched it. I've got one episode left.
I like Evan Peters a lot. He's a good actor.
Yeah. I think it's very good. I think it's beautifully done. I think it's probably too long. Mm. 10 eps is a long.
Well, that's way too long.
But my other worry about it, and, you know, I'm fascinated by these kinds of cases, and I knew a good bit about Dahmer, but not in quite such detail. My worry was that it glamorised him.
Yeah, that's the accusation that's been levelled at it.
That was my worry.
A lot of the victims or families have complained about it.
Yeah.
I read.
Well, to be fair, we've talked about this before, haven't we?
But you do have to be careful in the dramatisations of that. Which is why it was clever when they did the Stephen Port one to do it from the perspective of the victims.
Yes.
And I do that. And now they're doing a new Yorkshire Ripper.
Yes, they are.
But from the victims. Perspective of the victims.
Yeah. I mean, that...
It's like the only way to do it, really.
It is.
To do it sensitively.
Well, the danger... I mean, I would level the same against the Bundy series, that it made Bundy almost too likeable.
Mm.
And that's where...
You need an angle, don't you?
I begin to worry, you know, about that.
Like the West one.
We've talked about this before. I mean, it's very good, it's very compelling, it's quite chilling, but I kept thinking... This man did some dreadful, dreadful things.
Yeah. Let's not sympathise with him.
No. That was my, you know, my genuine fear that, gosh.
I think that's fair.
I'm all in favour of that, those kind of examinations, but I think we've got to see it now from the point of view of the victims rather than from the point of view of the perpetrator.
Yeah.
I think that's... I mean, the families of Stephen Port's victims are now, quite rightly, furious with the Metropolitan Police, whom they believe didn't conduct a suitable investigation.
Well, I think that's absolutely fair.
I would have thought it was probably fair too. And I think, to be fair to the Met, they've begun to acknowledge that perhaps they weren't taken seriously enough.
Well, he absolutely wouldn't have killed as many people if he had been properly policed.
Yeah.
Simple as.
Yes.
Not the first time that's happened, though.
No, nor will it be the last.
Nope. Nope, nope, nope. Oh, well, very good, very good. Look forward to the next one.
Yes.
Next week. Thank you to all the people that help us. Our producer, Sam Brain, my brother, Dan, who did the music, my friend, George, who drew our caricature... to Audio Boom for hosting us, to Jeffrey for all the hard work, and to you, the listeners, thank you so much.
And thanks to Molly, who after all came up with the idea of this podcast, and we've kept it going for 5 years, which is a small miracle in itself.
It's actually our anniversary month.
It is. So here we are, 5 years at the dining room table.
Happy 5 years.
All I'm doing is getting older.
Ditto.
But as I always say at the end of it, thank you so much for listening, and do please be careful out there.